Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now, on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network. And you meet, not
by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance.
Chuck Martin is with us. He's the CEO of the Mobile Future Institute and director of the Center of Media Research at Medias Post Communications, Inc. As a digital pioneer, researcher, and public speaker, he has his thumb on the pulse of the interactive marketplace, and he's had it for over a decade now. He's the author of The Third Screen, Marketing to Your Customers in a World Gone Mobile. Chuck, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. I think the book in and of itself at this stage of the game, when we talk about marketing, has got that window of opportunity. We are in a situation right now that we have a brand new e-consumer, and if businesses don't realize that there's a new buyer out in that marketplace, I think a lot of them are going to be in trouble.
That's exactly right. In this new, what we call the M for mobile, the M-powered consumer, they're actually behaving differently than previous consumers because they're basically empowered with much more technology in the palm of their hands while they're in the shopping experience. This is all the way from researching what they're going to buy to the actual purchase itself. And this is the first time that the customers are actually ahead of the businesses in terms of what they're going to do. And the research we spent the time in the last year, year and a half researching the book, we found so many companies, they are just absolutely clueless about what to do about mobile. So they're really going to need to do a lot of catch up.
Oh, sure. And one of the things that I've noticed, I've got something here locally in the Milwaukee area, and it's a website. It's called beepbeep.com. What it is every auto dealer in the area, every car in that auto dealer's lot, and you can sit at home at your breakfast table and check out everything that's out there, negotiate a price, buy it over the internet, and it's got a Carfax and everything else. And I think one of the things that the consumer has the edge at this point of the game, Chuck, is that everything is visible. They do their own research, and you can't tell them anything but what it is, and most of the time, they will, quote-unquote, in their minds, know more than you do.
Well, that's interesting that you bring up that product that you have there, because there's another national product called Cars.com, which started some time ago. It was a consortium from some of the newspapers who are really disadvantaged because of advertising loss. But Cars.com, they carry all the car information with links to Carfax and so forth. And the last car that we bought it 100% through Carfax through our mobile phone. And we ended up buying a car a few states away from where we live because we researched the market. And when we would look at cars, we would be walking out to the car with the dealer. And before we got there, we had all the stats on our phone of the car. And we knew way more than the dealer, than the salesperson, the poor salesperson. We can look at the history of the car, and we had all this before we even got to the physical car to look at.
Now, by the way, there is something called a smartphone. What is that?
Well, there are really two kinds of phones. There's the typical phone, which they're now called full-featured phones because they do a little bit more than voice. And right now, the market is kind of split. So there's a regular phone, which does just phone calls. Then there's a smartphone, and smartphones have a lot more technology built in. Those would be able to surf the web. They'd be able to do location-based kinds of things. You'd be doing video on them. So smartphones are, and I'm sure your listeners know about these categories of Android and Apple and BlackBerry. They're all making smartphones. And right now, in the U.S. market, the smartphone penetration is about 36%. by the end of this year, it's going to be 50%. So 50% of people will have smartphones. So anyone who does have a smartphone, you're in the majority right now. You're not in the minority. But it'll be 50% have smartphones and 50% don't. And what we see is a dramatic increase in smartphone usage after that because of the value that you can get through a smartphone is just phenomenal in terms of what you can do from what we were just discussing, shopping for cars, to actually scanning products right at a store and finding a product for a significantly lower price within 2 miles of where you're located, because smartphones have location built in. They have GPS built in. So they can tell where the phone knows where it is. You may not know where you are, but the phone knows where you are. So they're building a lot of applications to help basically serve the customer better.
Now, by the way, I have a BlackBerry, and I got to tell you, Chuck Martin, I hate it. But I'm working with it. It's smarter than I am, and I don't want to admit to it yet. But we're working our way through to get a relationship going here. I'll take you all the way back to 1983, Fairbanks, Alaska, the interior. In those days, I used to smoke in those days, and in those days, what we had to work with was a wooden desk, an ashtray, and a telephone. I think we've come a long way.
You said 83?
Yeah.
Did you have the big brick phone?
Yes.
That was the first cell phone.
Yeah, no, I got it. I remember it was Reagan and the Pope that were up at the university in Fairbanks, and I remember them coming down to turn on the street, and I was standing there about maybe 7 or 8 feet away from the car, and I had that big brick phone, and I was calling the station back with it. Yeah, you bet. That was the beginning.
Yeah, that was Motorola. Motorola spent $100 million to develop that phone and to buy them. I don't know if you remember this. It cost $4,000. I had one too, and you had a half hour talk time, and it would last for 8 hours if you didn't talk on it, just in terms of standby. The phones have come quite a long way since then. And, of course, now the carriers, at least in the U.S. marketplace, they're subsidizing them so that you go down and get a phone for a couple hundred dollars, but the phone is worth a lot more than that. And people would be paying a lot more than that if it wasn't for the carriers and these multi-year contracts and so forth. But this is a global phenomenon. There are 75 countries around the world where the number of cell phones actually exceeds the population of the country, like by a lot.
Sure.
In Canada, for example, 50% of the Canadian households are wireless, 25% in the U.S. are. In China, there are 750 cell phone subscribers. Japan, for years, have been swiping their phones for payments. In Korea, people for, I think, 4 or 5 years now have been watching broadcast TV on their cell phones. So it's come quite a long way. The big change was in April of 2007 when Apple introduced the iPhone. And it's not because it was Apple or the iPhone. It's because it's the first time that the marketplace and consumers could see what could technically be done in this little handheld device. And it really turned a lot of heads. And it revolutionized. It was the beginning of the revolutionizing of what was going to happen with smartphones. And that's where we are right now with Android. Android is now the largest operating system. It just overtook pretty much everybody else, including BlackBerry. And BlackBerry's been losing market share consistently. What's interesting, though, is when you people like you, and you are not alone, you are in the majority of people, you get a smartphone, and you may have had a phone before that was, say, a clamshell, which is, you know, those, it looks like a clamshell. It just opens up, and you just talk in it.
Sure.
The phone that you move to, the BlackBerry or iPhone or Droid or whatever it is so much better than your previous device that you don't necessarily take advantage of all the aspects of it yet. Just like when people get high-definition TV, they very frequently don't subscribe to a high-definition service, so they don't get the full benefit of high-def TV because they're not getting a high-def broadcast. However, because the TV is so significantly better than their previous television, which might have been 10 years old, it's such a dramatic improvement, they don't realize it could be even exponentially improved beyond that. And that's where we are with smartphones. So there are hundreds of thousands of apps, which are things that allow you to do things on these smartphones, and they take literally seconds to download, but people don't have hundreds of thousands of apps on their phone. They don't even have 100 apps on their phone, really. They find a few, like weather.com, which is sort of that's the number one or number two content app literally in the world on smartphones, and maybe their sports team and a couple of functional things, and that's kind of where they are. So there's still really a long way to go. And people are going to get there because they're going to see how other people are saving money through their smartphones and all of a sudden they're going to learn what they have to learn because they want to save money too.
Oh, sure. And one of the things that the smartphone did, it leveled the playing field, you know, because there are so many people today because of the outsourcing that have gone into their own business. They're sitting home, they've got their computer, they're entrepreneurs, and a lot of them are making some really decent money. And what this does, it allows them to be competitive to the bigger guy. They don't have the expenses and they can work right off of their phones and their computers to make a lot of money if they know what they're doing, if they're smart enough.
That's right. And another advantage that small businesses have, the small business person very often is very closely connected to their customers. So they can actually, as silly as this may sound, they can ask their customers what they do with their phones. A lot of the large companies, they haven't a clue that customers are going into their stores and scanning something and leaving their store because they found a better deal elsewhere, and they're just losing revenue. They have no idea. But a small business, they can actually ask, and they say, what do you do with your phone? Do you have a smartphone? Do you have a regular phone? What have you got? What kind of a smartphone? Because we found, in terms of when we were researching the third screen, what we found out was that the different platforms of phones, whether it's BlackBerry or Android or Apple, the users of those phones actually behave differently than each other. So if you are a BlackBerry user versus an Apple user versus an Android user, each of those three lives in their own world. So you have in BlackBerry, you have your world of apps, and it's not like other devices, like looking at websites. You look at your things within the BlackBerry world. In
sure.
The Android world, the same thing. The person looks at their things in the Android world, and everybody's phone is highly personalized, and it's always on. So it's a customized personal, it's a highly personal kind of thing that people are carrying around with them that they set up the way they want. It's like people. There are no two that are alike. So it's a real challenge for a business because one of the common mistakes is a business thinks that everyone is doing things with their phone just like the person is doing with their phone, and it's not necessarily the case. So companies need to be really careful about looking at what their customers are doing, not necessarily what they're doing personally.
So you truly have to have a collaboration with that customer. The customer has to be part of your marketing program. I think the biggest mistake a lot of businesses are doing now because of this crunched economy, they're discounting that, they're doing this, they're doing that, and they're going outside and they're not getting what they got before. Building from within is the real key here. And you can build from within. And with what you're talking about here with the third screen, you're in constant contact with those customers and then those potential customers. So building from within, keeping what you got, and at the same time, there is no way that you can't give them a message immediately. You find something out, and you're seconds ahead of your competitor.
That's exactly right. If you look at the first two screens, the first screen was TV, and that was broadcast, so the company could kind of push out the message when they wanted. And the second screen was the personal computer, the PC. And that became more interactive, but the mobile device is extremely interactive, but it's not a push medium, it's a pull medium. So a company or a business can't push information out to the phone. The customer with the mobile phone, the untethered consumer, they're not tethered to any device like the first two screens. The untethered consumer pulls information to them when they want it based on where they are and what their mindset is. And this is the first time in history that this kind of pattern is emerging. And companies, they're not yet set up for it. So the first screen, you were tethered to the device. You had to stay at the TV to watch it. The second screen, with the PC, of course, you had to stay at the computer to do something there. The phone actually goes with you. It's 100% portable device, and it's always with you, and it's always on, and it's always front of mind. When you leave your house, you may forget your keys, you may forget your wallet, but you don't forget your phone. So it's a
that's bad.
And ultimately, the wallet and the keys will be incorporated into the smartphone, so the smartphone will be doing all of that. There's technology coming. Actually, there's technology here. It's just not really widely adopted yet, that you'll be swiping your phone to pay for things, or you'll be bumping your phone against a device that pays for things. At Starbucks right now, you hand your phone at checkout at Starbucks, you hand your phone, and it has a barcode on the screen of the phone at the Starbucks account. They scan it with their special scanner at checkout at Starbucks, and this is nationwide. They scan it, and that it pays for your whatever you're buying, and it instantly debits your account. It updates your account right in your phone, which is all managed at your smartphone level. So this is the kind of thing that's going to be common. It's not common yet, but it is in fact going to be common, where people will be pointing their phones at something and getting a lot of information just because of they pointed at what the device was. Yeah, I mean, you can point at a can of Coke or Pepsi, and the computer and the phone will come back and identify what that is. It'll tell you the content of it. It'll tell you, and that's just by looking at the can. It's not by reading a code or anything.
Sure.
The phones can actually identify objects. So you can point it at a building, and all of a sudden on your screen, you can see the history of that building.
Chuck, we're starting to run out of time, but there's one area I want to touch on very quickly, and it's in your talking points, which we touched on it, but it's critical to the marketer, to et cetera, the location-based marketing. I mean, you're there. You don't have to go anywhere to get information, and you're constantly there within a millisecond to that customer and that customer's wants and needs.
Yeah, that's absolutely – location is huge. This is the first time that supply and demand could be linked to time and location, which never could be done. And there are two kinds of locations. There's location-based marketing and location-based services, and they're very different. Location-based marketing, a company can build what's called a geofence. So they can have – when a person gets a certain distance from a store, certain distance from a front window, certain distance from a product, they can have a fence that nobody sees that can actually identify where that person is when they're getting close and then send a message, so you've got direct communication to the customer. The other kinds of services are called location-based services, and these are they're called Foursquare, Gowalla, various groups of these, where individuals communicate with each other based on location. So you might check into a Starbucks, for example, and you can see that you've got three friends at the same Starbucks, and that's where the consumers are talking to each other, but the company is not yet part of that conversation. So they have to have offers sort of around where those locations are so that they get found by the customers, because they can't go directly to the customers. The customers have to find them. So location is going to be very big, because it's going to get down to within just a few feet of knowing where the phone is and then providing value. And from a privacy standpoint, consumers can turn these things off in a second. So it's not a big deal.
Chuck, we're about out of time. Chuck Martin, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, a website, and you can see the mobile version of this is called thirdscreenrevolution.com. That's thirdscreenrevolution.com. If you pull it up on your smartphone, it will be a mobile website. There's a check mark at the bottom. If you check that, it will convert to a traditional website. So you can see the difference between a mobile website and a traditional website. They are different. So that's thirdscreenrevolution.com, and the book is obviously The Third Screen.
No, and one other question. If you're old enough, do you get to get Prozac with the whole thing when you're figuring it out?
it actually is not that hard to learn all this stuff. But once you start doing it, BlackBerry is hard. I've got to tell you, BlackBerry is harder. We have BlackBerry, so we've got all the phones here, obviously. BlackBerry is harder because there are not as many apps or functions that exist for the device itself, and they've got some challenges ahead.
No, I hear it loud and clear, and I've got one. Hey, Chuck Martin, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
Great to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. Bangkok,
Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Amy Robbins-Wilson with us. She is the author of Transformational Mothering, a prayerful companion for new mothers. She's also developed two CDs of lullabies along with innovative mommy jingles. That's the program. And let's say, Amy, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm good, and thank you so much for being here. A mom is not the same mom of 10, 15, 20, 25 years ago, but because the culture changes, but the kids, when they're born, they're the same kids that were born 300 years ago. And based on what they get, who they, how they're communicated with, the interaction from the mother is going to be how they're going to turn out. So I really think that right up front, if you catch them right up front, it doesn't matter what's going on in the world, you could have really healthy, happy kids.
Absolutely. I'm with you, Michael. You know, what has changed so much is the geographic distance between generations. I mean, it's sure. very rare to be in the situation where I am, where I actually live with my parents just down the road. And actually, when my son was born, we were in a different state. And within 6 months, I had found my husband a job back in Maine. So, but not everyone is that lucky that they can just kind of move home. And what I try and do is to bridge, to sort of give moms the tools that they might get sort of by osmosis if their mom was beside them or their sister was beside them.
No, when we're talking about moms and kids, et cetera, and I know one of the things I know you talk about, because it's got to drive a new mom nuts. Everybody in the world is giving that mom advice, but they're not there with that mom's particular child. How do you get around that without insulting everybody?
Well, with a lot of good humor on both ends, hopefully. You know, you just have to realize that when a mother has a new baby, she's going through a huge transformation that's hitting really many dimensions of her life, from the physical, the emotional, the intellectual, the financial, and the spiritual. So everything in her life has changed. Now, you know, if you just take a new job, you dream about it at night, you wonder if you're doing a good job, you're sensitive to every kind of criticism, and you're trying to do the best that you can. Well, maximize that, Michael, times about 100, and you've got where that mom is. And
well,
then you think about all the sleep deprivation because she's getting up at all hours, you know, to make sure that this baby is taken care of. So you're not necessarily, you're in a very, very fragile place when you're a new mom. So even if someone says, you know, isn't motherhood wonderful?
Yeah.
Which it is. You know, but I remember a mom saying that to me when I was just so tired I thought I was going to throw up. And, you know, I wanted to say, yes, motherhood is wonderful and motherhood is blissful. But I always wanted someone else to say, oh, but it's also, you know, a real challenge to get through those first few months. And what I try and help mothers to look at is to sort of look at the birth as a rite of passage. And then that whole first year is getting used to being a mom and developing yourself so that you're the mom that you want to be. And then the criticism isn't quite as sensitive. But if you feel like you immediately have to be the perfect mom that you envision, you know, that's a hard place to start from, because
let me hold you up, because I think a very important thing, I want to get this point across before we go any further. The mom that everybody thinks you should be, and I think that's where the key is. You know, the perfection, the perfect mother has nothing to do with who they are. The perfect mother is going to be you, and the definition of perfection is the highest form of function. And that no matter what kind of advice they give you, the end result, the result and effect of you and that child, the communication, the bond, is going to affect those kids for the rest of their life. And just because somebody has all this great advice, sometimes we have to listen to their advice and turn around and see their kids. There's something called, it did it work that well? But the mommy stress, the mommy stress, I think, is important to talk about, because I, as a male, I will never understand mommy stress. And anybody who hasn't had a baby will not understand mommy stress. And I really believe that moms, before, you know, when they find out that they're pregnant, there should be a class that they take so they can be pre-warned about everything that's going to come up and they can anticipate it, and at least it'll take some of the stress off.
Well, you know, that's the hard part, isn't it, Michael? Because you can't really, it's the one of the things in life that you just can't really be prepared for, because you don't know what's coming. You know, you don't know if your baby's going to be colicky or if your baby's going to be a good sleeper or, you know, and so much emphasis is put on the birth right now. It's sort of like we prepare for the wedding, but we don't necessarily prepare for the marriage. And we prepare for the birth, but we don't necessarily prepare for that first year. And I think that there is some education that can go on about just basic schedules, some of the things that might happen to you, some of the intrusive thoughts that you might have. You know, the statistics vary widely because it's very hard for experts to sort of decide when someone is in the baby blues or not. Generally, it's if you're feeling down for more than 2 weeks, then that's postpartum depression. But there's such a wide range. But there are some statistics that say between 50 and 80% of all new moms go through the baby blues. So it should be seen really as something that's a very normal part of the transformational process.
Now, by the way, moms are normal human beings, and normal human beings get competitive. Do you run into that? Do moms undermine each other?
Well, you know, I think that all that does happen. There's no question about it. But I think so much of that comes from the insecurity that we feel as new moms. You know, we all want gold stars as moms because there's so much that we're doing and we want someone to see it, you know. And when we find something that works for us, we think, oh, it works for us. It must work for everybody. And so we want other people to do things the way that we do them. So really, it's coming from a place of wanting to help, but it is sometimes received as criticism. And sometimes, you know, it's given as criticism. You know, my
sure.
way is the right way. And, of course, it is the right way for you and your child, but it may not be the right way for you and your next child or for me and for my child.
No, and absolutely, I mean, there's no question about that. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, the arguments that you get back and forth and the recommendations of how to raise a child, it's going to be modeled from the mother, from their mother, from their mother, from their mother, and all the way back, and throw in the mix of the, you know, the culture and whatever's going on in the world today. But I think that most mothers, they've got a chore that a lot of people really don't get what a mom has to go through and all of the challenges that a mom has to go through. And I imagine that it's got to be pretty rough.
Well, and you know, Michael, that's exactly why I wrote this free report that I put up on my website, amyrobbinswilson.com. It's Understanding the Transformation of Motherhood. And it talks all about those five dimensions that I talked about, the physical, emotional, intellectual, financial, and spiritual changes that you're going through. It's got an exercise that you can do with your partner to sort of talk about what are my assumptions about what a mother is. And so you can sort of align your ideas before the baby comes. It gives you 20 questions on how to set up a support plan for you after the child comes with great ideas. Like if you're going to have a baby shower or a blessing away, absolutely ask people to sign up to bring a meal for you for those first couple weeks. See if you can get someone to bring, you know, a meal for you every other day for the first 2 or 3 weeks that you're home, just to take some of that stress off you. And it's got a lot of other great ideas too, plus musical MP3s that you can listen to.
I was saying, good.
Yeah.
don't ask me to spell it, but it was, good, MP3s. By the way, you said something I thought was absolutely brilliant. The we move through life and we have certain definitions of something. You know, we hear a word and the definition is the literal translation is the definition. The connotation of that word is the definition plus the emotional impact. And then you get into something else. You get into the state of mind of the receiver. You know, what are you feeling like when you hear this word? It's going to come at you 2 or 3 different ways. All of that said, it would be interesting if you could survey. You could do a focus group on 10 brand new moms and also 10 moms to be and ask them, what is a baby? And it's going to be very interesting to see how everybody would define it.
That is fascinating, Michael. I would love to do that. And it would be interesting to do it before you give birth and then after you give birth. And then when your baby is about a year old. You know, I just remember those. My baby was up every 2 hours around the clock for the first 10 months. And it was just exhausting. And I did not expect that that would be the way that it was, you know. And, you know, in our case, it was extreme because my son almost died twice in his first 2 years. So there was a little extra stress there.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, I just can't tell you the power of just a few kind words. If you're someone in the grocery store and you see a mom and she has just calmed her baby, just to go over and say, wow, I just want you to know that I think you're doing a great job. Or if she's holding the baby when they're checking out, you say, wow, look at how your baby loves you. Wow, you're doing a great job. If a new mom hears that kind of a thing, it can really get her through a lot of tough spots.
Now, by the way, really, we just, Amy, if you listen to this very closely, we just created your next book.
Oh, yeah.
No, listen to this. It would be, the name of the book is What's a Baby? By 10 moms, right? And you interview 10 women before they're going to have the baby. Then you interview them 3 months after they've had the baby. Then you interview them a year later. And I'll bet you can create an entirely new book out of it.
Wow. I'm liking that, Michael. Very interesting.
Yeah. But, I mean, nobody's done anything like that. And I think that would be very powerful. I mean, I wonder how many moms would like to know, because you hit it. What, as if I thought about that before, I never have. But the key is, what is a baby?
Right.
And I wonder how many lives would be changed if you could define it.
And what are your, it's all about our expectations, isn't it? I mean, all of life is really about what our expectations are and how reality meets those expectations and how we deal with that.
No question about it. And I think that's realistically what it is. And it would be this way. If you wanted to, if you took yourself out 15 or 20 years into the future and you imagine yourself at a dinner party and it was in your honor, and then you would write down what you want everybody to say about you. Now you've got it down on paper. Now you know what you want. You got 10 or 15, 20 years to become that. And wouldn't it be interesting if you could define the baby and then step by step, almost like a business plan, and define what you want. You get to a certain point, what you expect to happen. If it has happened, you're on point. If it hasn't, you can readjust.
Very neat. Very good idea.
No, but I think it would be a great book.
I think it would, too. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll have to ask some moms on my my mailing list if they might be interested in something like that.
There you go. And you want to find 10 moms that are, 10 mothers-to-be. And they've got to be mothers-to-be that's never had a baby before.
Right. Because that's when the big shock hits, I think. After you've been through the first year once, you know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. But I think what makes the first time so challenging is that you're like, wow, is there a light at the end of the tunnel?
Where's my life? Yeah, do I get a life of my own? No. But and I really do believe there's also a balance there. You can be the absolute greatest mother in the world, and you can also balance it where you don't have to lose your individuality. You don't have to put this mask on to pretend you're somebody else while you're going through this process. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people. They can't deal with the stress of whatever's going on at the time, and they move into this other identity, quote unquote, which protects them.
Well, I think it's definitely a dance. That there are times when, like if your baby's very sick, there is no time for anything else. But on a normal day, there's definitely time for you. And, you know, so you have to sort of dance between those dance around the situation and sort of find where the rhythm is that's going to work for both you and your child and your family and what you do for a living.
Now, by the way, Amy, why I think it's so critically important, you know the old that old adage about if you're on a plane and there's a problem, you have a baby in your arms and the oxygen mask drops. You know, you put it on you. You don't put it on the baby. The reason you put it on you is because you know what to do to help the baby. The baby can't help you. And I really believe that's that same thing when you're and I speak from an outside perspective, obviously. But I think that when you're a mom, there's that point of if you lose yourself in the baby, that baby's going to model after you. So whatever you do to dilute yourself, somehow it's going to come out with that child later on in the child's life. But if mom's balanced in whatever way that you do that, if mom's balanced, that's what the child will model after. That kid's going to model after every way you are.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think, too, that mothers can often find themselves in sort of a double bind in the first few months, because if their baby is a nice, calm baby, everyone says, oh, what a good baby. But if they're acting up and they're crying and throwing fits and stuff, it's like, oh, that mother ought to be doing something different.
Yeah.
You know?
Got
so,
a lot of it.
So there's really not a lot of encouragement coming back towards the mom. And that's why I think a mom can feel like she's got to do more, be more, because everything falls on her. And it becomes very hard to sort of reach out and ask for the help and the support networks that every mom needs to do. And again, that's something that I talk about in this free report and how to ask for help, because it is so crucial. And, you know, new moms can think, well, you know, I wanted my baby, I love my baby, why am I feeling this way? And it doesn't mean that you don't love your baby. It may mean that you're just incredibly tired and you just need someone to hold your baby for a couple hours so you can take a nap, and then the world is a whole different place, you know.
No, absolutely. Now, Amy, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at?
AmyRobbinsWilson.com is definitely the best place. I've got, as I said, the free report, the music downloads. I do a weekly podcast, and you can also find me on Facebook there. So it's AmyRobbinsWilson.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. I think that the book in and of itself is great. And if you write the other book, let me know.
All right. Thanks so much, Michael. It's been a joy.
Good night.
Good night.
Promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a loving's burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Gary Murphy with us, VP of National Accounts for AMA Waterways, has been in the travel industry for over 20 years now. Previously president of Brendan Vacations, which was founded by his father, Jimmy Murphy, in 1968. AMA Waterway is the premier river cruise, listen to the words, the river cruise line in the travel industry, and is currently operating 12 ships throughout Europe, in Russia, and on the Mekong River in Vietnam and Cambodia. Hey, Gary Murphy, welcome back.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be back on the show.
Boy, it's been a long time since we've talked.
It has been.
It really has. How's your dad?
He's well, thank you. Thank you for asking. You know, he's out pounding the pavement, out there promoting the product and enjoying it.
Absolutely. Now, by the way, the emphasis was on river cruises. Everybody thinks a cruise, you can get out in the ocean. But there's so many people who miss it when it comes down to a river cruise. It's in the river that you get to see more of those countries that you didn't know anything about. There's more of a bonding to it.
Well, it's very interesting what's happened. We though I've been in the business for many, many years, as you mentioned, Ama Waterways, we just started up in 2002. We started building our own ships in 2006. So our oldest ship is 2006, and now we have 12. So even during these, you know, challenging economic times, river cruising has just, you know, bucked the trend and is booming, because people that experience river cruise understand the benefits of waking up in a beautiful port, you know, centrally located. The great cities of the world were built on these rivers, and the oldest part of the city is on the riverbanks. So you're in that crucial area for the best sightseeing and the most wonderful experiences. And you just get off the ship. You can go on your guided tour or go on your own and get back on. The next day, you wake up or someplace else.
Now, by the way, Europe, Russia, the Mekong River, and Vietnam and Cambodia, which one is your favorite? Which is the one that was your trip?
Oh, boy. you know, I really used to like the Danube for between Budapest and Nuremberg. And that's our most popular selling itinerary. It's a seven-day itinerary. But in April, I went on the Mosel or the Moselle, which comes off the Rhine towards France, and we end in Luxembourg. And I think now the Moselle is my favorite river. It's there's not as much traffic on the river. It's you know, there's no cargo really going up and down the Moselle, where you find some of the, you know, cargo ships on the Rhine and the Danube. And it's a narrow river. And so you know, some of the oldest cities in Germany, Trier, they say the oldest city in Germany is on the Moselle, and it's just a delightful river. It's the steepest vineyards in Europe line the banks of the Moselle. And so I think that's my new favorite.
And I think one of the things that, and I'm going to go back to river again, I want to make the emphasis there. You know, I've spent time on cruise ships, I've worked on cruise ships, and the key is there's a certain amount of enjoyment that there is, but it still keeps you a little bit separated from the indigenous population, et cetera. But you do the river, all of a sudden you do the river, and it's a completely different experience. And I don't really believe that most people know that you can do a river, you know, a river cruise, because that's very special. Cruising is great, there's no question, but the river cruising, that's something that steps above it all.
Well, it's a relative new market, and you're right on point. Most people don't know what a river cruise is. You know, we have ships, there are 148 passengers, up to 160 passengers, beautiful cabins starting, you know, large for a river, for even the cruise ship, starting off at 170, but going up to, you know, 400 square feet. All-inclusive, meaning your sightseeing is all included and everything else. But when, you know, even if they walk into a travel agency today and ask, I'm interested in going on a cruise to Europe, the travel community still fully hasn't embraced or the understanding of river cruise. They'll probably give you a cruise out of Venice. They're not thinking of giving you a cruise on the Rhine, the Danube, or the Rhone through Provence, or even the Douro in Spain. They're not thinking of that. But in saying that, thankfully, the business is booming, not only for Ama Waterways, but some of our competitors, too. So I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about river cruising over the next few years as the market expands.
And there's another area of consideration. When you do the river cruising, especially in the areas that you're talking about, you're reliving history. History was in Europe. History, you know, most of us come from that particular... Oh, it's the White House. They're after us again. But most of us come from that particular place, when you really come down to it, that a lot of people came from Europe. A lot of people came from Spain, came from that area. And that in and of itself, they go back and they can actually feel and see and experience their own ancestors.
Well, you know, you've got, you know, the great cathedral in Cologne, or the parliament buildings in Budapest, or the opera houses and all the beautiful, beautiful historic structures in Vienna, or, you know, Amsterdam. You know, the canals of Amsterdam were built by the, you know, the experienced Dutch traders, you know, trading, you know, being the exporter importers for the world back in the 1800s. So it's all developed from the rivers. And what's also interesting is you have these beautiful towns like Würzburg, where there's a bishop palace that's like a small Versailles. We do a walking tour of that palace, and then in the evening we go to the largest wine cellar in the world and do a wine tasting with the wine room, or the being illuminated by the wine cellar being illuminated by 1,000 candles. And it's towns like Würzburg that, with the introduction of highways and rail, have completely skirted it. So people go to Heidelberg or they go to these other iconic spots, but they really don't see some of the most beautiful spots that have been forgotten because the only way you can really get to them is on the rivers. And yeah. But people, I mean, they're going and they're coming back and they're going again and again. And the ship is not the destination. Like the big ships, you know, that when they're building the ships with 5,000 passengers, you're really going to see the ship. With us, our ships are beautiful, but you're not coming to us to see our ship. You're coming to us to go to Bamberg or to Cockham and see these gorgeous historic properties.
You know, by the way, the other thing, too, is with everything that's going on in the world today, people have to know that it's still safe to go out there and to do what they're going to do. People have stepped back and taken a look. The areas that you're talking about have got to be the safest areas in the world.
And Americans, you feel very, very welcome. I mean, when you're cruising through, you know, any of the reasons we're going, even with our cruises through Vietnam and Cambodia, when we cruise in and we go into a village, the whole village comes out and, you know, welcomes us with open arms. We, you know, we have a guided walking tour through the village. We might go and visit a rice paper factory or whatever the commerce is of that village. But you can feel very, very comfortable, even with the history that our two countries may have had. Right now, the Vietnamese people see us as, again, as a way of developing their future. You know, now that we're trading again with Vietnam, it's, you know, we're helping employ their people by, you know, well, they're doing a lot of manufacturing over there. But, you know, we're going there, we're exchanging, we're meeting each other, we're exchanging thoughts and ideas, and it's a joyful experience. People come back with a feeling of enrichment after going through these areas.
Now, the other fun, too, Amma Waterways is now that you're doing theme cruises, and that's a kick.
Yeah, I'm glad. Michael, you're really doing your homework here. You are. We are doing theme cruises. You know what? I just came off a cruise where, for the first time, we went to these wineries. And what we have this November is we have theme cruises where we have vintners from the United States. We have Sterling. We have Rodney Strong. We have Tinchero. We have Ferrari Corona. We have their wine specialists from their wineries going on our ships. We're having their wine shipped to our ships. Now, on our cruises, we have complimentary wine throughout dinner. Champagne with breakfast, beer at dinner, so it's all included. But what we're also doing is now bringing these California wines, and we're doing some taste testings on the ships and going ashore to local wineries and doing some sampling there with their local with their local wine grower. I just did it in Rudesheim with a Dr. Nagler winery, and a gentleman there named Adolf did the most magical wine tasting experience in the vineyard. And then we went down into a cellar, and it was like a 200-year-old cellar. It was magnificent. And then he asked me if I wanted to see the old cellar. And then we went to another part of the cellar that was over 300 years old. And what we're doing now is letting people experience that on a river cruise. And on the big ships are doing wine cruises, but they actually never visit a winery. Where we are, we're docking right at the winery, and you're walking up and experiencing it.
You know, but the key, too, is everybody thinks that cruising is summertime. And it's not necessarily, because you've got the wintertime Christmas cruises also. And people don't think about cruise during the middle of December.
Well, you know, it's the Christmas markets start in Europe, and they open up in the last week of November. And what's interesting, on a river cruise, you have 160 passengers going into a Christmas market, which is teeming with locals. I mean, it's locals or people from the surrounding area going into the Christmas market. You have your hot mulled wines. They call it glue wine. They have all these types of schnapps and, ciders. But they also have each market has their own specialty. Like in Nuremberg, they're known for their gingerbread man. In Prague, they're known for their Bohemian crystal. So you go from a market to a market every day, in addition to seeing other interesting sights, and it really brings on a wonderful Christmas feeling. It is to see these magical cities and towns and villages go all out for the Christmas holidays. But you know, Michael, I forgot to tell you, and I don't know if you even know this, but now our river ships all in Europe, not only do they have a computer in every cabin that's with free internet access, and that's all included, we have 35 touring bikes on each ship for people that really would like activities. For example, from Dürnstein to Melk is 23 miles through the Wacker Valley on the Rhine. And so you can get off our ship in Dernstein in the morning and meet the ship for lunch at Melk, riding along these beautiful bike paths where there's no highway near you. You're right along the river. So we're really sort of mixing it up now to, you know, make it more active. You can be as active as you like, or you can be as sedentary as you like on a river cruise. And so you can really, really experience the local environment. We're getting your hands in the soil with the river cruising. You're not seeing it from far away. You're actually in there experiencing it.
One of the things, Gary, that we've gotten over the last couple of years are these mixed economic messages. You know, if you listen to the major media, those outlets, what you're going to hear is everybody save your money, don't do anything, we're going to crash, et cetera, et cetera. That's not necessarily true. And I think that when it comes down to it, you guys have proven that. In this economy, you guys are still booming. And what does that say about the economy? It means it's still going. People are just are not admitting it's as good as it is.
Well, you know, it's interesting in that the cruises are selling extremely well, and next year's sales are already far ahead of this year's. And I was just talking to my father about this morning, sort of interested about the economy. And yes, we're at a 9% unemployment. 9% of people interested in working can't find a job, and that's tragic. But flip it around. That means that 91% of the people that want to work are working. So I know people have been hesitant maybe for traveling. Because they're not to travel or spend because they're concerned about what was going on in the economy. But now after 2 or 3 years, you know, they're thinking, God, the world's not coming to an end. I still have my job. We haven't gone anywhere in the last couple of years. We have money in the bank. You know, there's no dress rehearsals in life. Let's go out and enjoy it. And they're looking for value. And so when you look at a price river cruise, the per diem may look a little high. Maybe you're at $250 a day per person. But when you think that includes all your meals, all your transportation, all your sightseeing, you know, your free movies, all these, it's a good deal. And so I think the educated traveler is saying, well, I see the dollar has suffered a bit over in Europe, but look at the prices river cruise. You know, the prices haven't changed, and it's all-inclusive, so let's go. And I think you're right. Some people have, you know, they've heard the naysayers now, you know, the sky is falling for the last 3 years. And unfortunately, a lot of people have been impacted, and I don't want to, you know, lighten that situation
or not identify it.
But a lot of people are still making money.
But Gary, you said the operative words. You know, you look at the reverse side of that. 91% are still working here. And one of the great things I think about a cruise is so much stress is going on politically, this, and that. It is time for some people just to get away. And what a perfect place to do that. You're catered to, you're safe, you know, and obviously, if you really listen to what you're saying, you're treated like a king or a queen. What more could you ask for on a vacation?
No, it's a nice time. I mean, I have a 14 and 16-year-old daughter, and we went on our family vacation last August. We went to Indonesia, and I was standing at the airport, and she's asking me, you know, how long is the flying time, Dad? Where are we going? How are we getting there? And after I explained the flying time to Indonesia, my 14-year-old said, Dad, why don't we just not go on another river cruise? Why don't we just go on a river cruise again? And I thought, what an endorsement that my teenage girls are turning their nose up at a trip to Indonesia in preference they'd rather go on a river cruise. And the reason is that with a family, an extended family, and I've gone with my parents, you can all get together for your meals. You can do certain sightseeing programs together as a family, but you have the opportunity of going off on your own. You know the ship is leaving at 2 o'clock in the morning from Budapest. You just got to be on that ship, you know, before it leaves. So you can have your meal on board, walk into town with your kids, enjoy all the illuminated buildings and come back, walk on the ship. But my mom, she preferred to stay on the ship and listening to the evening entertainment, which might be a quartet or some Hungarian gypsies playing on board. So there's something for everybody on a river cruise.
Love every second of it. We're starting to run out of time. Website, Gary, we can find you at?
It's amawaterways.com. So that's AmaWaterways.com, AmaWaterways.com. Or any retail travel agent has our information. And the great thing about a retail travel agent, you know, they do their homework, and they will help identify the best package for you. And they have our information. Retail travel agents all have our AMA Waterways brochures. But feel free to come onto our internet. We have DVDs. We have brochures. We'd be glad to send them to you.
Wonderful. Hey, Gary Murphy, thank you so much for being
Michael,
back.
All the best.
Yeah,
take
don't
care.
Be a stranger. Bye-bye.
Bing bang, I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug. Flip flop, they were doing the bop. All the tunes had the dancing bug. There was Lollipop with a Peggy Sue. Good and golly, Miss Molly was even there too. Well, a splish splash, forgot about the bath. I went and put my dancing shoes on. I was a splishing and a splashing. I was a rolling and a strolling. Yeah, I was a moving.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And our next guest, we're going to talk about college rules, how to study, how to survive, how to succeed in college. And before I introduce Sherry, Sherry, help me with pronouncing your last name.
It's Olenek.
Olenek. See, I knew it. Yeah. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, Sherry, stay in silence.
Okay, no, I wanted to make sure that we got it. Sherry's a professor at the University of Georgia, former director of the Division of Academic Enhancement, an active researcher, sought-after lecturer. She's published numerous articles, textbooks, focused on studying and learning at the college level. And let us say, Sherry, hi, formally welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
And thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about college rules and studying, just because someone goes to college doesn't necessarily mean they know how to move through all of those challenges and roadblocks that they come up against. The survive and succeed in college. What have you found has been an overarching theme that has caused the most trouble for kids going in?
Well, I think most students are not really ready for the rigor of college. That's one thing. And then along with that, a lot of students go into college with the idea that it's, you know, grade 13, and they can just get on partying down like they did in high school, especially when they were seniors. And many of them will fall into a black hole in their freshman year. If they get behind in their freshman year and they make poor grades and they're not academically doing very well, college is going to be difficult for them. And so we, you know, one of the things we always suggest to students is that get off on the right foot. You know what you're doing. Know the college is different from high school. It just isn't grade 13. And there are things you have to do. You know, you're responsible for yourself now. Mom and dad are not going to wake you up in the morning, get you out of bed, get you to class. They're not going to make you study. So you have to have a lot of self-discipline when you go to college. And many students, many high school students go into college not having that. They've had their hand held with many high school teachers. You know, not that high school teachers are bad. We think high school teachers are great. But the kind of hand-holding that they've had, where they've had a test every week on information that they've learned, lots of grades. If they didn't do well on one thing, they could make it up on another. So there's just many, many differences that students often have a very difficult time adjusting to in college.
It's a different world out there. And one of the things, I'm going to give you an extreme example, and then we'll talk about how kids can fall down unless they know this particular thing. When I was in high school, I've never been, how do I say this? I've always been able to grasp what was being taught. If you talked it to me, I had it. I mean, there was no question. I understood everything. But if I took a test, I could never pass a test. Ended up, I found out when I was 17, 18 years old, I was dyslexic. So I had to learn. I had to learn differently. Now, there are kids that really, they don't know how they learn. They can't put a handle on it. They can't define it. And I know one of the things that you talk about is the need to understand how they learn and also their beliefs about learning, how it influences them. I would venture to guess if you ask most people how they learn, they couldn't give you an answer.
And I would say you are absolutely right.
So how do you deal with this? When we, you know, it's covered in chapters 11 and 12, But what are one of the first steps that we can look at? Somebody who didn't know, somebody who learned how based on what you've taught. What are some of the first steps to learn how we learn?
Well, one of the things that we firmly believe in is that learning is really a complex a complex concept, which most students in high school coming into college have no idea of. They think that, you know, their method of studying in high school was probably just to look over a study guide or notes that they may have taken in class, look over their textbook. I would venture to say that many students, before they go in and take a test in high school, you know, study, I put that in quotation marks, 15, 20 minutes and go in and do fairly well. So that really doesn't give you too much information about your beliefs about learning and how you learn, because you think, wow, what I did paid off, and so it should pay off in college too. What we recommend in college rules, we recommend that students need to be able to learn through all of their senses. There's a lot going on out there, but with learning styles right now. Well, you're either an auditory learner or you're a visual learner. And although I do believe that students who were maybe like you with dyslexic have certain senses that they learn better in, because there are visual problems and there are auditory problems with students with learning disabilities. But for the 99% of students in college, they need to learn with all their senses. So what do I mean by that? Well, they need to read the text, their lecture notes. They need to go to class. They need to listen. They need to write. They need to talk about it with study groups or even to themselves. So the more senses you use when you learn, and this is anybody, it's just not college students, the more senses you use when you learn, the more you retain, and the more you learn and the faster you learn. Along with that goes the whole issue of what students' beliefs about learning are. One of the things that I did with my freshmen when they came into my class is I would say, okay, I want you to define learning for me. Tell me what you think learning is. Tell me what you think studying is. Tell me what you think reading is. And mostly when I asked students what learning was, they told me that it was learning facts. There was no concept that learning is basically putting facts together, putting information together to create knowledge. So because of that, then, they have these sort of beliefs about learning. They believe that learning is a certainty. Things are either black or white. They will often believe that learning is very simple. All I have to do is to know the facts. If I know the facts, I'm ready for an exam. Many students believe that learning has to be quick. If I can't learn it very quickly, then I can't learn it at all. And in fact, in the area of mathematics, 10th graders in algebra, if they can't solve a problem in 2 minutes, they quit trying. And so, you know, if I'm taking physics or if I'm taking chemistry and I can't do something in 2 or 3 minutes, then I'm done with it. I'm on to the next thing. So they believe learning is faster. I can't do it. The other thing about beliefs about learning is, well, who's in charge? You know, is the professor in charge of making you learn, or do you have to do your part? And we often call this the empty vessel syndrome. If I can sit in class and the professor can pour this knowledge into my head or beat it in some way, then I will learn it. If not, you know, it's not my fault that I don't learn it, because the professor's not teaching it to me. So those are just some things that these conceptions oftentimes that students come into college with. And in terms of beliefs, most students aren't even aware of what they believe about learning. Learning is just something oftentimes that's done to them. It's quick. It's either black or white. And if it's not like that, if they can't do well, then it's not their fault.
Yeah, and critically, well, two things that as you were talking, I was thinking about. Though, let's go to the it's not their fault first. There is a mindset with a lot of the kids today that won't take responsibility for their actions. And I'm not going to get into a whole sociological issue here. But for the most part, they're different than the kids from 40 and 50 years ago. You've got a different mindset, and you've got to have a different kind of a teacher, professor, etc., that's going to teach those kids. But when we talk about learning, there's two different facets of learning, the way we take in and we perceive our thoughts and ideas. You obviously left and right brain. And if you've got a left brain student out there that's very literal, they'll take the facts, they'll do what they're going to do with it. But 80% of those kids are not left brain, they're right brain. And they're going to take it in and they're going to add with their experiences to it. And that's how it's going to come out. And that in and of itself could be a problem.
Yeah, that's correct. You know, I firmly believe that students should use their past experiences, their learning experiences, to help them create new knowledge. You know, oftentimes students will go into a course and they don't think they have any background knowledge on it, and they really do. You know, students bring a wealth of learning experiences to college, but as you pointed out, sometimes those experiences can get in their way, especially if they have these beliefs about learning, that learning is, you know, is fixed and it's black and white and, you know, all I have to do is know the facts. And so oftentimes you're correct, that does get in their way, and students like that will have a very hard time adapting because they don't realize what they're doing in a sense, and oftentimes they'll spiral downward too far before they really realize how they can get themselves back on track. But you're right, and students are oftentimes not self-disciplined at all. They're always willing to blame somebody else for their actions. You know, we talk to students about, well, why did you perform poorly on a test? Well, my roommate was too loud. You know, the professor didn't lecture very well. I just had too many other things to do. I had three tests in the same day. So it's all of these excuses and not taking, you know, that responsibility for themselves and being disciplined about being a student.
And that in and of itself is a learned behavior. And I think the real gift for these kids when they come out is when they realize that the facts that they've taken in, when they can convert that fact to knowledge where you make it applicable in your daily life, then the world turns around for them. Some of them just haven't got that. Now, the other thing that you've talked about, Chapter 7, it's students need to be able to manage their lives. And one of the things about managing their lives, I've seen for years now, that they have to also choose the college that they go to, because that particular college, they may not be a fit. And if they are a fit, once they get in, now we don't have, and you said it, you don't have mom and dad laying the rules down. They're on their own, and they haven't been trained to be on their own. And that can cause a tremendous problem for some of these kids.
Yes, it certainly can. I mean, if we could go back to kind of college choice for a minute, we find students all the time that are at a large school like the University of Georgia, and it's just not a good match for them. You know, many of these students have come from small town high schools. They're used to knowing everybody. They're used to knowing their teachers very well and their parents knowing their teachers very well. They're used to having a much different kind of approach to learning. Everybody looks after them. And then they land on a large campus, and they're lost. And I'm not saying that every student from a small town can't go to a large campus, but choosing a match is a very important thing. Students' college careers can be made or broken by the schools that they choose. We talk to students all the time that, you know, why are you here? Well, because this is where my parents wanted me to come. And, you know, my dad went here and my grandfather went here and, you know, my whole family's gone here. But it may not be a match for that student. And so I think that's very important, and it really plays in to the, you know, the discipline that students are going to have, how they're going to manage their time, how they're going to be able to manage their lives on campus. It really needs to be a good fit for students. And, you know, I've oftentimes counseled students, you know, this isn't a good fit for you. Students are homesick, they miss boyfriends, they miss girlfriends, and, you know, they're probably somewhat immature. And, you know, when it happens that it's not a good fit for students, I think they need to move on, reevaluate what they're doing with their life. Do they want to be here? Do they want to be at home for a while? Do they want to work for a while? And, you know, in these economic times, that's hard, because for many students that have prepared to go to college, there really aren't a lot of options for them now.
Oh, no question. Sherry, one of the most important things that I think, and it's one of your talking points, you need to have commonality of definition. Most people walk into a situation, whatever it is, And they don't say to somebody, what do you want? What do you expect? And there's not that camaraderie between the two and meet that balancing point, that homeostasis. And I think it's extremely important. Number four, students need to be able to understand what their professors expect of them. And I think that's very simple if you could just sit one down or just say, what is it that you want? What do you expect? And then all of a sudden you're back and forth and you're on the same playing field.
Yeah, when we talk about professors' expectations and college rules, we talk about it as using the term task. And it's one of the things that sets college rules apart, because few books about how to succeed in college talk about the idea of task. And what we mean by that is, for every class you go into, the task is going to be different. And so unless you can figure out what the professor expects from you, what that task is, you're going to have a hard time, if you can't figure it out, you're going to have a hard time selecting the strategies in order to get at the information to do the task. And so by task, we mean, you know, not only the kind of test you're going to have. Am I going to have a multiple choice test? Am I going to have an essay exam? Am I going to have to do a paper or a presentation? Whatever that the task is. But also, what's the level of thinking that I need to do? So if I'm in a psychology class and, you know, the professor sort of, by the way she lectures and by the things that she says in class and the points that she makes, you know, I can assume that this test is going to be maybe based on facts. And so if I can learn the key terms and the definitions and the main people, I'm going to do well. But if it's a different situation, let's say it's a history class where the history professor tells you, you know, I don't believe history is a series of facts. I believe that, you know, the history is kind of a looking at events from a certain perspective and putting history into a certain perspective, and you're going to have to do an essay exam. That's a very, very different way of thinking about information. So unless students have a repertoire of strategies that they can apply to the psychology text or to the biology text or to this history text, learning that information for that class, they're going to have a very difficult time. And, you know, even if students go into a course and they can't figure out what the task is initially, after the first test, if they don't do very well and they studied in a certain way, they should run, not walk, to talk to their professor and tell that professor, this is what I did. I didn't do very well on this test. What am I doing wrong? How should I be thinking about this material? That's another thing, along with beliefs, that many students really don't have a clue about, that those professors' expectations and what they want you to do has a big influence on how you're going to study and learn.
But there's another key here, too, which I think would be absolutely brilliant if you could take your book, College Rules, How to Study, Survive, and Succeed in College. What would be wrong with having that as a mandatory course when a kid goes to school? I think if somebody would get this kind of information up front, right from the get-go, what a difference it would make with a tremendous amount of them.
Oh, I certainly agree with you. There are a lot of what are called freshman experience classes and freshman seminar classes that are using College Rules right now. And they are finding that students are being very successful with it. In fact, my alma mater, where I did my my graduate work, my PhD and my master's degree at the University of Florida, used this book in their freshman seminar class. And I've gone down and talked with them several times. And, you know, it's very, very interesting to listen to what students have to say once they've gone through the course and applied the strategies and, you know, followed a lot of the rules that are put forward in College Rules, that it's made such a huge difference in their lives. And you know, I think it's really important for students not only to be effective learners, but to be efficient learners. I truly believe that college is a lot more than having your nose in a book. So if you know how to have your nose in a book efficiently and know the strategies to use right from the get-go, then your 4 or 5 or however many years you plan to be in college is going to be a much more happier and much more effective. You're going to come out of there a happier person and a more well-educated person than had you had to struggle for the first 2 years to figure out what you're doing.
Yeah, and actually, it's the struggle that you can let go, and all of that work that you would have to do could be eliminated. The load could be lightened.
Exactly. And, you know, in the foreword to the book, I talk about my own experience as a college student, you know, a gazillion years ago. But I went into college, and, you know, I was a really good student in high school, and I was really excited about going to college. I was the first in my family to go, and, you know, I got in there, and I had a heck of a good time. You know, I sort of majored in party time, and around the middle of my sophomore year, my dad, you know, said to me, "Sherry, you were a good student in high school, and you're going to turn this around and make better grades, or you're going to come home." And for me, that was sort of a wake-up experience. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I was young when I went to college. And so there was a big wake-up experience for me, and I think it's a wake-up experience that that students shouldn't have to have.
No, but Sherry, your response to your dad should have been, "But I got an A in it."
Yeah, I guess, but I might have been home, and I might not have been here at this point in time. So
I hear you loud and clear. Sherry, we're just about running out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. And then Random House, who is the publisher of College Rules, it's 10-speed press, but it's an arm of Random House. There's a page on Random House website for Sherry Nistolenik. And there is also a web page on Amazon.
Wonderful. All right, so we can buy the book there. And by the way, the information...
Yes, you can buy the book on Amazon, and most Borders, Barnes & Noble, local bookstores sell the book as well.
Wonderful. And the information will be up on our website. Hey, Sherry, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time. I think the book is great. That could probably save, quote-unquote, some intellectual lives out there.
Well, thank you very much, and it was fun talking to you, and go College Rules.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. If there's someone you'd like interviewed on the show, a subject you'd like to hear, go to www.dresserafterdark.com. Get a hold of Radio Susie. She's running the front page, and she'll get you booked in, and we'll find out what goes on. As a matter of fact, that's how we grow. That's how we learn things. And it's everybody's got a voice. And sometimes those little voices inside that you keep hidden, it's about time that we get to see it. So let's go. Ellen McDale is with us. She's the author of The Bailout Sham, and she's the founder of The Financial Mall, a company dedicated to helping the working poor and achieve the American dream of home ownership. She's listed in the world's Who's Who of Women and is the author of, again, The Bailout Sham. And let us say
shame.
Hi. Shame.
Shame.
I'm ashamed of what I just said.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay. All right. By the way, The Bailout Shame. Now, there is a shame in it, isn't there?
Oh, there is.
Yeah. What got you interested in this? What got you to take a good long look at this and say, this doesn't look right on the surface, and then you dug, you found out?
You know, Michael, my company, which I started in the year 2000, the mission is to help the working poor get to own homes, because that's the only way that we can kind of reduce the grievous inequality between the very rich and the working poor here in America, okay? Because wealth accumulation in America is largely owning your home, right? So anyhow, I was actually in an airport, and here I am reading about Wall Street and all of the bailout things, and I just got so angry because this is my turf, if you would, right?
Sure.
I'm trying to help these people, and here comes Wall Street, abusing these working poor. I call them my FMs, the financially marginalized folks, financially marginalized people of America, okay? So I kind of finished the book, you know, while staying at the airport there. And the reason that I wrote it is because I wanted to explain in simple layman's terms the chicanery and all these bad things that Wall Street did that culminated in our Great Recession.
Now, by the way, let me hold you up just for a second, Ellen, because I want to go back to Wall Street, and let's go to that real estate debacle that we got in, the home foreclosure, et cetera. One of the problems we got into was there were these salespeople selling homes to people they knew could not afford the home. So they got the houses going. Then what the banks did, the banks packaged up the loans that they made, sold them off, and then those were sold, et cetera. We know what happened to them. So in essence... Yep. There were people who couldn't afford a house in the first place that for their own sake shouldn't have gotten into that dream to have it taken away from them. Somebody should have stopped it a long time ago. We wouldn't be where we are right now. And as far as people who are wealthy and making money, my goodness, if it wasn't for a good amount of those people, there wouldn't be the jobs that we have because of the people that you're talking about couldn't make the money to afford the home in the first place. So there's got to be some kind of a balance here when we look at the economy and what drives it and where there is inequities.
Yep. Okay, let me backtrack, okay? First of all, the credit card industry, which for a while there was the most profitable industry in America.
No question.
Those are owned by Wall Street credit card companies, right? All right. Well, it started with the abuse of what I called these financially marginalized folks being abused by the credit card companies, okay? You probably know about all of these abuses. It's like penalties, you know, payments are received, but they're not recorded, so penalties have to be put on these people's accounts until the interest rate and penalties are so high. Okay, so that's one abuse. But they made great big money by doing that. For example...
But Ellen, let me hold you up, and I appreciate where you're coming from, but let's work our way through this thing. And you're absolutely correct with what you said, but there were people who make a lot of money that got the same abuse with the increase of the interest and the penalties and the rates. Years ago, you know, we had something that stopped the amount of percentage, the amount of interest that can be charged. We don't have that anymore. Somebody let those credit card people go wild. The regulations...
Yep, they did.
Yeah, but that happens to everybody, not just people that are short of money. I know people that are very wealthy that got themselves over their head with credit cards because they've spent in not the hundreds and the thousands, but they've spent the tens of thousands and used a credit card and they got in the same exact position. And I really think,
I agree.
Yeah, what we have to deal with is everything that you're saying is correct, which would happen. There were abuses, no question. But at the same time, there's a balance between what they did and the irresponsibility of what we did as the public by just going out and using the credit card anyways. It's not money. It's a piece of plastic. Go enjoy yourself.
That's right. But you see, there's a world of difference, Michael. If I am making, let's just say, $1 million a year, and you're making $50,000 a year, there's a world of difference between the sense of responsibility that I should have financial responsibility versus you. We're just worlds apart, okay? You charge your food, you charge your medical, health care on your credit card. I'm properly insured. I have three homes.
Sure.
I have three boats or what have you. World of difference. Okay?
Sure.
So now, if I may just continue with this thing. So these people
Please.
Were abused. But then Wall Street said, gee whiz, there's 100 million of these Americans who, because their credit scores are dismal, we can't give them home loans. There was a time when, if your score is not as high as 620, you don't get a home loan. So they said, okay, let's see. Let's do these subprime mortgages. All right, where essentially we'll ignore the credit score. Okay, in fact, this is what we will do. We will also ignore the so-called debt-to-income ratio, which is, your debt divided by your income.
Sure.
All right, and then merrily approve them for these subprime mortgages, which are adjustable rate, no documentation. The reason behind it is it's more money on the table. But that's at the end of it, okay? All right, so they did that. They collected all of this mortgage fees and what have you. And then they said, hey, wait a minute. We can still make more money this way. Why don't we bundle these mortgages into securities and bonds? So here comes the MBSs, okay? The mortgage-backed securities, which are nothing but stocks. And then
sure.
Here comes the CDOs, which are collateralized debt obligations, nothing but bonds, right? And then they didn't stop there, Michael.
A Ponzi scheme. I mean, that's really what you're looking at, a Ponzi scheme. By the time you package it and sell the package to another package and it gets incorporated, I'll just pick some numbers. That original $1 million worth of property is being sold for hundreds of millions of dollars, and when it crashed, the actual values came out, and that's where everybody lost their whatever on.
No. Okay. Let's talk about leverage ratios.
Sure.
Okay. What Wall Street did, for instance, is if they had $1 million, okay, they'd invest in a million dollar worth of whatever they are, MBSs, these mortgage-backed securities, or these CDOs,
sure,
collateralized debt obligations. Okay. But they can buy, with just $1 million, they can buy $30 million worth of these things. That's
Absolutely.
Okay.
I agree with you.
Yeah. And if I may finalize this flow here, the final thing is, okay, so they've got these MBSs and CDOs, and then they said, hey, wait a minute, there's another money-making venture that we can go into. Why don't we do credit default swaps? Meaning to say, I created these stocks and these bonds. What if, something happens and I lose my money? Well, bingo. Let's have an insurance policy type called a credit default swap, which is what AIG, of course, sold from London, right?
Sure.
So what did they do? They created and sold this credit default swap. So if their investments in mortgages, whether stocks or bonds, fizzled out, by golly, they're insured. Right? It's an endless stream of abuses by Wall Street. And it's all paperwork.
By the way, no question. There was no way that anybody would even argue that fact with you because there was abuses. I think the key here is you said the word collateral. That's it. When you start to leverage, collateral is the problem because you've got a number up there that is not 100% collateralized. Maybe you got a tenth of it collateralized, and if it ever comes down, which it did, there's where the problem is. Now, there were a certain amount of the Bernie Madoffs, the rest of them. There were a certain amount of people that took total and complete advantage, and I don't think that there was a line that was drawn between the impoverished and those middle class and those making money. They were just out to make their money, and I don't even think that they were targeting a particular group.
Okay, we can argue that, but let the statistics speak for themselves, okay? The main victims of the subprime mortgages, which I call the subprime shame, by the way, okay, are something like this. Among Black Americans, it's about 55%. Among Hispanic Americans, it's about 44%. Among white, Caucasian Americans, and Asian Americans, it's 17%. So So there's something racial here, you know? And so my premise is this, Michael, today it's no longer racial discrimination. It's credit discrimination.
Now, by the way, it transcends it all. But let me take you to task on that one.
Yeah.
Respectfully, it transcends it all. Has nothing to do with race. Now, you get people. I think what happened too when we had that influx of Latinos coming in from Mexico and south of the border, they took a lot of the jobs that the African Americans had because they worked for less money, which threw a lot of African Americans out of work. Now you got a problem that's a round robin problem here. We did NAFTA, and when we did NAFTA, everything was fine in Mexico, and then somebody decided they could make. Get labor for less, and they ran it to China. When everybody ran out of work there, they came across the border. When they came across the border, they took the jobs away from the African Americans. And it was a very interesting chain of events. And then if you come back and you say it was the Caucasians, it wasn't the Caucasian. There was a select group of people, and there were, you know, there were mixed ethnicities that decided to steal money, and they stole money, and there's no question about it. And I don't necessarily think that just because somebody's, you know, African American, Latino, or Caucasian, that there's that battle between. I think that people are making money by keeping us divided.
Okay, first of all, I happen to believe that in America today, we have two different economies, or I dare say that we, well, part of some of us Americans are in a third world economy.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of us are in a developed world economy. Okay? I'm really talking about the working poor and the rich. Okay? The working poor, let's talk about jobs, right? Gee whiz, what is it like? It's 13.7 million people without jobs nowadays. What does President Obama do? He comes up with his 787 economic stimulus, of which 288, of course, are tax cuts, which I'll go into later, all right? But what he focused on are green things, green buildings, green energy, green whatever, okay, which are highly technical jobs. What we need are labor-intensive jobs because many of these 13.7 million people are not high-tech people. You know, and we have so many jobs that are labor intensive that we can provide them.
Ellen, and I stand to applaud you with that. Yes, absolutely. No question about it. They're not hitting the mark. They're not hitting what the problem is.
Yep. And what's the problem, you think, Michael?
Well, but let me give you another problem. I'll get into that. I'll give you an answer for that.
Okay.
But
I want to talk about multipliers.
Say again?
I want to talk about multipliers.
Okay, multipliers.
Forgive me,
okay.
I'm an economist, okay?
Okay, yeah, no, just for a second. One of the major problems that happened was in schools. Years ago, when 100 years ago when I went to high school, they had wood shop, they had auto shop, they had all of those things that taught those kids that were going, that were not going to go out for ongoing and continuous education. They taught them skills that they can go out and work. They don't teach that now. So you've got the educational system that's part of this problem. You've got the politics that's part of this problem. And then you've got the economy driving us in a direction that's out of control.
Yes. Okay. But let's face facts as they are now, right? If indeed there's something like 12 million Mexican illegal immigrants, say it's true, whatever it is, right? But these people are not high-tech people. And, you know, we can't ship out 12 million Mexicans back to Mexico in the first place. They used to own Texas, you know, and Arizona and New Mexico. But never mind, right? They're here. Let's take advantage of their being here. We have 4.5 million manual pollination jobs that they can take over. I'm sorry.
No question. But who's in charge? Who's stopping all of these things? It happens to be the administration. Whether you're Republican or Democrat, I don't care. It doesn't matter. Right now, it is the administration. You said it all. There's not the manual jobs. We should be drilling oil here If we drill oil, that creates jobs. We should bring back manufacturing here. That creates jobs. But right now, we're sending it all out, and if we're not very careful, we are going to be a third world economy.
Okay. Let me bring you to the real world, or my real world. Okay. I said we have both a third world economy here in the U.S. and a developed world, if you would. You know, Michael, let's wake up. We have to compete with China's, you know, abysmal low wage rates. Okay? We just have to. We just have to. It's like, let's be like Walmart, you know, where all these new immigrants come in and they're so happy just to have a job. They don't care if their wage rates are not too high. Let's be realistic, okay? We have people here that do not have the skills but can, for instance, pollinate flowering plants. By the way, you do know that we have a crisis with our bees mysteriously dying. So there'll come a time when maybe we won't have any vegetables, no fruits, no what have you. It's a $90 billion business. And you know, there's a Chinese technology called manual pollination, whereby these poor people who don't have any technical expertise, et cetera, can at least do manual pollination of flowers and what have you.
Alan, the real problem, let me hold you up, the real problem with that is this, that obviously China does the manufacturing, we import from China. We don't export almost anything anymore. But if we stop importing from China, guess what? They're not going to loan us any more money. That's where the problem is. I'm dead against that. But at the same time, that's what you have as far as the economy goes. If they stop loaning us money right now, we're in trouble. And I'm not saying that that's right, but that's what it is.
Okay, we do owe China a lot, but what I'm saying is we have to face up to that and do something about it, okay? Let me go to another country. In India, there's this guy called Bunker Roy, a very wealthy Indian, in fact, of royalty, I think, okay? He created this so-called Barefoot College where he taught illiterate rural women, no read, no write women, how to manufacture solar collectors. Gee whiz, if he can do that, why can't we do it here? I'm saying we have a labor force here that can be employed for labor-intensive things, like the Barefoot College kind of manufacturing, like this manual pollination thing. And then, let's wake up. Okay, we have to compete with China. You want jobs to come back to the U.S. at our wage rates? Let's be realistic. Law of supply and demand, they're not coming back because we're too expensive. What we should do is we should export our high-tech people in these BRIC countries, you know, Brazil and what have you, these developing countries, and we will live like kings in these foreign countries.
We'll live in villas,
we'll have maids, etc., and then we can be paid the wage rates that we're used to being paid here in America. We just have to bring ourselves to the real world.
But wait, let's get to the real world for a minute. Let's look at what happens that if we effectively do this on a competitive basis. When we compete with somebody, we have to look at the bottom line that's going to come in. We compete. One of the problems that we had in competition when we went global is you've got employers taking out Social Security. They're taking out FICA taxes. I mean, they're taking things out that the other countries don't have to compete with. Pretty soon, our businesses are going to be demanded on to buy insurance for every one of the employees. That's another burden on the business, and that's a whole other issue. So what we have when we start to compete with the business, you've got all of these dollars and these areas, these factors incorporated into what the business has to spend, lowers their competition ability, so they can't compete with anybody in the East or the West.
But you know what, Michael? If there's a will, there's a way. Look at what happened to GM. Everybody says the government is so inefficient, you know, they can't do anything right. Look at GM's turnaround. Look what they did with their labor unions. Look how they negotiated. And boy, the labor unions negotiated, right? There are solutions to these problems. We just have to have the dedication and the focus to solve them. For instance.
The we is not the, and administration to be able to do that, because there are regulations that have been incorporated into our ability to do business. Ellen, listen, we're running out of time. I'm going to have I'm going to have Susie Greenman get a hold of you, and I will bring you back, and we will continue this, because I think it's a conversation that everybody should hear.
Yep, and I still am dying to share my solution to the foreclosures problem and our jobs crisis problem.
Okay, I'll tell you what.
We shall talk again.
Okay, I got to go, but what she'll do is she'll set a time up, and we will go directly into that.
Okay,
and by the
wonderful.
Way, that, and do we have a
it
website?
It was lovely talking to you, Michael. Looking forward to another chat.
Okay, we need your website so we can buy the book.
Yep.
What's your
coming
website?
Coming up. My publisher is
coming up. Okay.
As soon as it's available, I'll let you have it.
No problem. As a matter of fact, she'll get a hold of you, and then we'll go from there. And thank you so much for being here.
Okay, thank you very much, Michael.
Bye-bye, good night.
Goodbye for now.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Terrence Slack with us. He's an author. He's a motivational speaker. He's a recording artist and the founder of High Expectations Motivational Production Company, LLC. He also hosts a TV show and is the author of A Matter of Life and Death. The book details his heroic efforts in the days. We got you. Okay, Terrence. Okay, Terrence,
yeah.
You there?
Yeah, okay, how you doing?
I'm good. Am I getting an echo? Are we getting an echo?
I'm not getting any.
Okay. No, they those guys are so good over there at the board, so we're in good shape. Terrence, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, we hear so much about New Orleans, and we heard about what happened to Katrina. We heard what happened after Katrina. You were there. You were involved in it. You moved through it. Through your eyes. Yeah. What don't we see?
New Orleans has come back a long ways, you know, thank God for that. But we still have a long way to go as far as a lot of the schools are still not open. The recreation departments are not up to par. We still have a lot of, you know, job loss down here. And there's still a lot of people that are still in different states that want to come home that's just not able to come home right now. So that's pretty much what's going on now.
Now, by the way, we pour billions of dollars into countries all over the world. What happened to getting us back on our feet here? This is how many years ago? You're talking 6 years ago, and it still hasn't been put back up on its feet and where it was before Katrina happened. Where is it? Where's that stall? What's that stumbling block? Who do we have to go to get this thing fixed?
Well, what's happening is the government did put up a lot of money for it. It's a program called Road Home Program, whereas they assist the people that's out of town or out of state to come back home, because those, you know, a lot of those residents need that money in order to rebuild their homes. And then a lot of that money is deadlocked right now. I mean, our local government, I don't know if you know about our local government, but our local government is not the best in the world. So, you know, a lot of that money is locked up, and they're shifting money from here to there to different programs, and people are still trying to come home. So it's just like deadlocked, and the people is really, we still having meetings every day. I mean, the government, it's the citizens versus the government right now, and we are still just trying to get the money loose right now.
No, but what happened to your local officials, your representatives? Are they helping at all? Are they listening to you at all?
Somewhat, but there are so many local, there are so many problems within their own departments right now, you know, and as far as the citizens are concerned, I mean, we had to rebuild everything, the police departments, the city halls, the libraries. I mean, everything had to be totally redone pretty much, you know. So there's so much to go around, but if you don't have the citizens here, then it's not going to move. I mean, a lot of stuff has come back, but it's still a lot with the local government and shifting money around. And, you know, it's just some issues right now that we're fighting against right now.
And by the way, I think the biggest problem with it is this, and you being someone who's lived there, were you brought up there?
Yes, raised here all my life in the Lower Ninth Ward, which the Lower Ninth Ward was what we call ground zero, where the levee breach actually happened. My house was like two blocks over from the levee breach, so the Lower Ninth Ward was like ground zero, and it's really, if you go down there right now, there's a few houses that Brad Pitt built, the actor Brad Pitt.
Sure.
And he put some money, he got some people into their homes, but it's still, it looked like a ghost town back there, really, actually.
See, I think here's where the big concern is, and Terrence, when we take a look at it, I was in New Orleans years and years ago, way before this ever happened. And New Orleans always had what I felt, it had its own culture, it had its own feeling, it had its own life. And you destroy something like that, which is the guts of the base of what America's founded on, you know, cities like that.
Right.
And you take that away and you let that go, it's a slap in the face to the culture that we were brought up with.
Exactly. Because the way we look at it, if New Orleans goes, the state goes. Because sure. New Orleans is the foundation of the state, actually, you know.
Now, by the way, if you had the wherewithal, if you could be quote unquote the king of the United States and everybody had to do exactly what you said, how would you fix it? How would you go back into New Orleans and get it back to where it was? What would you do?
First, what I would do, some of what they already have in place, which is, okay, the government have the money available, because the way it was right after the storm, the household was supposed to get like $150,000 per household. That didn't happen. And then a lot of actors and actresses, you know, they put up a lot of money, so we don't know what happened to that money. But you use the money that you have, and you make the money available to the people. But for some reason, they want to hold the money. I mean, you got to let the money go. That's what it's for. It's allocated for, you know, to help the people get back into their homes. So you pretty much just let the money go, and you work on the levies, which they are fixing the levies. As a matter of fact, we're kind of on hold right now from the water coming up from upstate when all the ice melted from the snow. So it's coming through. It came through Tennessee and Mississippi, and now it's coming. I don't know if y'all are aware of what's going on out here. So we're actually on hold because we're trying to watch the levees because the water's really high right now. So we're going through a lot of that right now.
Now, Terrence, there's got to be some kind of a regulatory committee. There's got to be somebody in charge of that. There's got to be it's got to be illegal somewhere to hold on to that money that was targeted to do a specific thing, and especially what it was targeted to do to get you back on your feet again, quote unquote, the city and the state actually. So who's at fault? Well, we say the government. There's got to be somebody in the government. I don't mean a particular person, an agency, a department of something. It can't be legal.
Well, what happened was it started out with an organization called the Road Home Program. That's a government program. Then it went from there to the governor. I think the governor is in control of it now. The money has totally shifted around. We are so confused. We don't know really who is in control of it now. We the people are trying to find out where is the money and who is in control because, you know, so much has changed in the last 6 years. But they're still saying they have like $30 million left. But they're holding on to the money. But as far as I know, it's coming through the governor.
Now, by the way, are there attorneys locally that can band together and to work on this, because what you're dealing with are rules. You're dealing with legality someplace, and you're dealing with somebody holding on to something they shouldn't be holding on to, and there's got to be a way to get it let go.
And you're exactly right, because we have, like, radio shows such as yours here in New Orleans, and they're, you know, really trying to organize the people, and there are lawyers on the shows, and they have a lawsuits are being pending right now, as a matter of fact. So you're right on point with that. There are lawsuits pending.
Okay, so there's steps that are being made right now. The governor himself, when it's time for re-election, you know, if he hasn't done the job at this stage of the game, he can get out and get somebody in there that will do the job. That's the one power that we have. We do have the power of the vote. And if the people who are in charge are not running it the way it should be, they can always leave and say goodbye. I think this is an absolute travesty.
That's right. That's right. I mean, hey, it's like I may be running for office soon, you know, because it's about the people. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I may not have the high quality of some of the people that's, you know, and a high education, but it's all about the people. You know what I'm saying? I have a heart for the people. And that's what that job is. You're a public servant. We don't work for you. You work for us. You see what I'm saying? And when they can understand, I think they do understand that. But, you know, power, when some people get power, everybody don't know how to handle it. So, you know, we just have to deal with them, because the power is in the people. The people have to understand that the power is still in the people.
Yeah, but by the way, absolutely it is. And I think what you just said it, that some of the elected officials have forgot who works for who. And I watched mm-hmm. it in some of the, you know, some of the public forums, some of the town hall meetings. I lost my word. Some of the town hall meetings. And I've watched mm-hmm. the attitude of the elected politicians to the people. It's the people who are their strength. And sometimes they forget, again, and you said it, who is working for who. They're working for us. And it's about time they realized that.
That's right. That's right. And we're going through that on a daily basis. I mean, some of our local politicians are so arrogant. You know, to this, it's just ridiculous. But, I mean, like you say, you deal with that in a voting booth. You know what I'm saying? That's how that goes.
Okay, let me ask you a question, Terrence. What can everybody else outside of New Orleans, what can everybody else do to help?
What they're really doing a lot, because there's still volunteers that's coming here and helping us rebuild schools. And I just want to thank the world for that. I would like to thank everybody in the United States of America and abroad that came down here and helped us, you know, college students, high school students, to give up their spring breaks, to give up their summer vacations. And a lot of that is still going on. And, you know, just really pay attention, because we're still going through a lot here locally, and just kind of pay attention. And because we're trying to outsource, we're trying to bring it to the people, not just in New Orleans, but because we still have a lot of people outside, but to the country. And you may start beginning to see a lot of that, because we're trying to bring the message out there to let the world know. Because, you know, it's all about all the political people, all they're concerned about is the tourism. You see what I'm saying? Long as our tourism is back. But you got to think about the schools and the other department, the recreation, the stuff for the kids and the colleges and universities that's still struggling. So we just want y'all to keep our eyes, stay focused on us, and we're going to try to put the message out to you all as best we can. And we may need your support one day, you know.
Yeah, now, by the way, and the message in and of itself is not just for New Orleans. The message is for every city in this country, the same thing can happen, maybe in a different way. Maybe it's not going to be a Katrina, but there could be a Katrina, but there could be some kind of a disaster. And if New Orleans has set the model of what's going to happen afterwards, we better take a long look at what we've got and who we voted in and where our money goes.
That's right, and that's the message that we're trying to portray to other cities and other states, because you can be us. I mean, hopefully you never experience what we experience, but, you know, it's a lot of that going on in other states, too, because I listen to a lot of talk radios from all over the world, and it's a lot of the same issues that's going on with government. So it's not just New Orleans. It's around the country right about now, you know?
Yeah, I think what's going to happen, and I think the big call to arms, the big wake-up call that we're getting right now, Terrence, is that things have been out of whack. There are a very few people that have done things with money that shouldn't have been done, and people have been at the mercy of the economy, and we've been turning into something that we're not already. And if we're not very careful, we're not going to be the country that you and I grew up in.
That's right. That's right. That's right. You're right about that, because I love this country. I really do. I love this country. I love peoples, all races, all creeds, and all colors. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. If you the way I see it, if you've been selected, especially if you're a public official, you know, do your job. You know what I'm saying? Because if I go to my job every day, which is at a university, and I love my job, the minute I'm not doing my job, guess what they're going to do? You got to go. So, you know, it's just that simple. And that's what we have to do to them.
And when it comes to government, we're starting to run out of time now, but when it comes to government, there is no ethnicity, there is no gender, there is no race. It is one solid American way to do things, and they forgot that. And they got to be reminded. Once we get back together, we can get that balance going and come together, because there is a divide going on in this country now that shouldn't happen, and that in and of itself is causing the problems that that stop us from fixing things like New Orleans.
Right.
And whatever that meant. Okay. Hey, do you have a website we can find you at? Terrence, you still there?
You want to go forward, but you got to don't forget about the basics, though.
No, absolutely. We're starting to run out of time now, but do you have a website we can find you at?
Which you can go to the publishing company, xlibris.com.
All right, so if we go to xlibris.com, and it'll be up on our website, we can find A Matter of Life and Death.
Yes, sir.
Wonderful. Hey, Terrence, thank you so much. Terrence Lack, thank you so much for joining us. Keep it up. Somebody, it's going to take people like you for other people to listen to. So go get them.
All right, thank you. I appreciate you for having me on the phone.
Okay, not a problem. And thank you so much. Good night.
All right, good night.
Develop in your brain that's ringing,
making a crazy ding dong.
And if this band don't desert us,
then there's nothing.
Now we got the right song.
Off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtain's falling, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Curtain falls.